The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. And I want to say I do have a Philadelphia connection. It's where I got my name, Ehrenreich. I was married the son of two longtime Philadelphia residents, Joe and Frieda Ehrenreich. And if anybody knew them, please come and introduce yourself. Somebody raise their hand. Great, okay. So let me tell you how I got into this new project, Bait and Switch, this recent project. This grew out of the earlier book I had done called Nickel and Dimed in a very, sort of natural way. A lot of readers of Nickel and Dimed write to me. These are people in poverty, overwhelmingly, who write to me. People often in pretty desperate circumstances, people who may have gotten an eviction notice or have been diagnosed with cancer and have no health insurance. I get lots of these letters. I began to notice something interesting, that many of these people said they had college degrees, even master's degrees, and that they had at one time had a pretty decent-paying, white-collar, generally corporate job until the layoff came, or the downsizing, or the right-sizing, or the smart-sizing. There are a lot of interesting euphemisms for what's been going on. Or the outsourcing more recently. And then, you know, sooner or later, a lot of these people wind up down at that kind of nickel-and-dimed, low-wage poverty level. So as Toby explained, I decided to investigate what was going on among the white-collar unemployed in the way I had done with Nickel and Dime, by actually entering into the situation physically, and that meant in this case going undercover as a PR person. That was my idea. I changed my name. I had a fake resume as a PR person. I felt, well, how hard could this be? I mean, no heavy lifting, no floor scrubbing like there was in Nickel and Dimed. And besides, if you look from the outside, it would be hard to tell the difference between a freelance writer and an unemployed person. You know, this. I thought it would be easy. Anyway, I'm just going to read a short bit because I am on a book tour. I do get to read little snippets here and there. Not something that nonfiction writers don't usually get a chance to do. But this is part of the motivation. Stories of white-collar downward mobility cannot be brushed off as easily as accounts of blue-collar economic woes, which the hard-hearted traditionally blame on, quote, bad choices. Failing to get a college degree, for example. Failing to postpone childbearing until acquiring a nest egg. Or failing to choose affluent parents in the first place. But distressed white-collar people cannot be accused of fecklessness of any kind. They are the ones who, quote, did everything right. They earned higher degrees, often setting aside their youthful passion for philosophy or music to suffer through dull practical majors like management or finances. They, in some cases, they were, in fact, high achievers who ran into trouble precisely because they had risen far enough in the company for their salary to look like a tempting cost cut. And while blue-collar poverty has become numbingly routine, white-collar unemployment and the poverty that often results remains a rude finger in the face of the American dream. So here I was. I had to figure out what to do. I knew that job searching was a little different than it had been. Well, I hadn't tried that many times in my life, frankly. But I knew that you don't go to help wanted ads anymore. There's the Internet. You can spend a lot of time searching on the Internet, posting your resume on all these job sites, applying to companies online. I also knew that because I read enough, it's very important to get out there and network, you know, go out, suit it up in your corporate best, and try to pass out your business cards to people. But how to begin? So I resolved I would take any kind of help I could get. And first thing I did was I found a career coach, pretty randomly, but what else to go on? Now, here's where things began to get very strange. I am a member of what one of Bush's aides once mockingly called the reality-based community. You know, any other members of that little subculture here, you know, that looks at facts and logic. Well, anyway, this is, and so I get this this career coach, unpleasant enough man. He wanted to give me a personality test. All right, And he gave me this personality test. It took a few minutes for me to fill it out. It took maybe half an hour, in fact. A lot of trouble. I couldn't figure out the answers to the questions, right answers, wrong answers, whatever. Then he analyzed this for days, and I had to go meet with him, and he told me there was some good news about my personality, but there was also some bad news. Mainly, I should avoid occupations involving writing. I had made a mistake, obviously, with my whole life. I had to wonder, why a personality test anyway? Career coaches do it. Corporations do it. You know, in the blue-collar world, the personality tests were pretty easy. They were questions like, agree or disagree, it is easier to work when you're a little bit high. That's very tricky. They almost got me on that one. But in a white-collar world, they have these tests, pseudoscientific tests, that are aimed at, you know, really probing the depths of your personality and your inner nature. My first thing I was wondering is, why? If I said I was a PR person and I have the personality of a embalmer, what am I going to do about that, you know? I went on from him, obviously, from my first coach, and two more coaches. I went to a boot camp for job seekers to turn you into a lean, mean job-searching machine. I went to all kinds of networking events. At first, I was quite shy at them, but I began to get more and more aggressive over time. I went to job fairs. I did everything I could think of to do. And I should point out that this plethora of things to do and people to help you and firms to help the white-collar job seeker is all fairly new. All this began to spring up really in the mid-1990s. That's when this so-called transition industry began to take off to help, or depending on your point of view, exploit the white-collar job seeker. And what prompted the emergence of all these new forms of help for job seekers is what can only be called a seismic change in corporate culture, American corporate culture, or policies anyway, in the 90s. And I'm surprised not more is said about this or written about this, but there's some, but not nearly enough. But it was a change, basically, from seeing employees as assets to be nurtured to seeing them as expenses to be cut or eliminated. You know, it was in the 90s that we had people like Al Chainsaw Dunlop, you know, who took great pride in reducing the ranks of his own company, Sunbeam. And then, this became the fashion. And in the 90s, it was very clear that the CEOs who downsized the most were also the highest paid. In 2004, you'll be interested to know, it was the CEOs who outsourced the most who got the biggest raises. So this is, an ongoing thing, this tendency to shrink the corporation. Now, I was seriously trying to get a job, and, in the sense that give me a challenge, even if it's sort of a journalistic one, you get into it. You sort of lose perspective. But I was continually, in this case, more so than in Nickel and Dime, for sure, distracted by the surreal nature of the world I had entered into. I had no preparation for this. First, the reliance on these personality tests. I should point out, anybody here ever take the Myers-Briggs test, for example? Oh, Well, you will be happy or not to know that it has been completely discredited. It is, you know, people can take it Tuesday and have a different personality than they had on Friday. It has, you know, it's based on nothing, but, you know, this was a surprise to me, you know, that corporations that presumably are very interested in the bottom line and doing things right would not even check out that these tests mean anything at all. Now, in fact, I strongly suspect that they're not looking for your unique personality. There's only one kind of personality wanted in the part of the white-collar corporate world that I was looking at anyway. And this was repeated so many times by the leaders of networking groups, by coaches, it's in the business advice books. It's a personality that is always upbeat, always cheerful, always accommodating, obedient, positive, smiling. Not, in fact, me by any stretch of the imagination. You can't go to a job interview pouting and being surly and passive aggressive. We know that. But it goes beyond that. And I've studied now a lot of the business advice books, too. There's a theory here, in all these nether part of the corporate world, that you have to be so positive because you actually control the universe with your thoughts. Yes, if you send out positive thoughts, if you beam them out, the universe will send you back good things, whatever you wanted, in fact, according to some of the books. This is a lot of power in your mind, in your thought forms, as one book puts it. Now, I'm not going to comment on that theory except to say there are medications for people who believe that. You know, if you think you control the universe with your mind, you could get help. But this goes along with what seemed to me to be very little interest in skills or experience compared to these sort of attitudinal things, this kind of persona you were always presenting. In fact, I began to get the distinct impression that too much experience was a handicap. I was worried about age discrimination, for example, right from the start, and asked my second coach, what about that? I said, I'm worried about that. She said, oh, well, you should have nothing in your resume that reveals your age in any way. Okay, but this means, she said, you can have no experience in your resume that goes back more than 10 years. Now, you know, I think age discrimination is an ugly prejudice on its own, you know, completely without saying any more. But it also amounts to a complete devaluing of experience. I don't know if any of you heard the show I was on this morning. What is it called? Radio Times. Thank you. I've been on a book tour too long. I can't remember. But if you listen to that, caller after caller was calling to say, it was sad stories. I'm in my 50s. I don't think I'll get back in. I'm out of money. I've taken a menial job, whatever. But kind of assuming at their age that there was nothing for them. I had a real shock a couple of weeks ago with a caller in another city. The caller said she felt hopeless. She'd been searching for a media marketing job for 4.5 years. She said, and her eviction notice had arrived. And she said, I guess there's no hope, though, for someone at my age. So I said over the radio, how old are you? She said, 35. So, you know, this cult of youth also, you know, means tossing out the experience of people. Now, you know, I have always had a lot of criticisms of the corporate world before I went into this research for Bait and Switch. But my criticisms kind of changed. You know, in the past, I would have been critical, say, of drug companies for some of the things that they have marketed and that have turned out to be harmful and for high prices and so on. I was applying now for PR jobs in drug companies, and I began to think, no, my new criticism is how do they possibly get anything done? You know, when you are hiring people, on the basis of likability, very big word that the coach is always impressive you on you, and on basis of having a good attitude and things like that, and who you know, that is, who your network is. Well, the result is you get people like Michael D. Brown heading up FEMA. Or maybe, and I don't know much about her, but Harriet Myers on the Supreme Court. You know, these are nice enough people, I'm sure. Michael Brown always seemed like an affable guy. But, this is the pathway to a culture of incompetence. I know Tom Friedman has been going around the country with his book, The Earth is Flat, and talking about the need to keep up scientifically and technically if our economy is to survive the challenge of India and China. But I would say something else. You know, we're not going to survive that challenge if we have a corporate culture of likability and niceness and getting along with everybody as well as you can. Now, I'm just going to read you another little section, a little tiny glimpse into my search, which is it was an odd experience. Getting nowhere after months of poring over my computer, applying online, constantly tweaking my resume and so on, going to networking events, I decided maybe it was how I look. Maybe I needed a makeover. I had gained the impression that the corporate world is rather stringent in matters of dress and appearance, and it occurred to me that maybe I didn't quite make it. And actually looking around this room, many of you also fall short of the corporate ideal, and I will be available for personal counseling afterwards. So I'm going to read, give you a tiny glimpse of this. This is where I've gone to an image management firm, which for $250 is going to put me together for the corporate world. Just as I would prepare for a visit to the dental hygienist with extra brushing and flossing, I have put unusual effort into my appearance today. Mascara as well as eyeliner, lipstick enhanced with gloss, jacket and slacks, tailored pink shirt. Only now, as I await Prescott's return, he's going to be the image management guy, are the multiple defects in my ensemble emerging. My pants socks, which I had taken to be black in the gloom of my hotel room, are actually navy blue, although my jacket is black. My watch cost $19 15 years ago, and the band no longer matches the face. Then there was the problem of the slacks, which I got at the Gap and the sales rack, and I see for the first time the zipper does not go all the way up. If I were wearing a pullover, this would not be a problem, but today I have, you know, this tucked-in tailored shirt. Anyway, when Prescott returns to the room, I lay out my situation for him and explain I'm trying to get into the corporate world. And Prescott nods approvingly and congratulates me for coming to him. Some job seekers neglect the visuals, he says. And then he tells me why it's so important to look exactly right. Because he says you want to look like a, quote, team player. And apparently this is a team that has a uniform. To find out what is expected, he suggests that before an interview, I call the reception and ask a receptionist at the company to tell me what the power gals are wearing. Unless, of course, it occurs to me the receptionist hates the power gals and maliciously advises me to show up in harem pants and bustier. Now we proceed to the material at hand, which is me. He first categorizes me as a type, which seems to, you know, all the career coaches were doing that too. He says, I am angular in shape. My face is shaped, quote, like a diamond, which suggests a teeny pointed head, but in fact refers to my cheekbones. They are wonderful, he says. I can keep them. He goes on like that about my type. I'm a natural in terms of clothing, meaning there, he says, there's not too much to change. But then he gets into the critique, which was rather painful. You see, I have to explain something here. You know, for men, the uniform is pretty clear, right? Suit and tie. You can make mistakes, though, in the colors and the fabrics. But for women, women are still trying to figure out exactly how to do it. And I'd read in the books not to look too feminine. that shoulder-length hair, for example, bad mistake. Very big mistake to be too sexy. I thought I had that part under control. So I had this kind of tailored approach. Well, it turns out there were too many lines and angles in the shirt and the lapel. And you know what? Lines and angles threaten men. I was had gone over to the word he used was to being too authoritative. And I should have been accessible. So I had to go, I went out and I bought a suit with curved lapels, which did not get me a job. But anyway, as for body language, Prescott continues, the way you're holding your hands on your waist, you seem to be holding something in. This is true. I release one hand and send it over to pick up the coffee cup, but the other hand must remain at its post, covering the gap in my zipper. It goes on. Like that. Now, a lot of this is, you know, was funny as it was happening to me. It was a truly bizarre, much of it was very bizarre experiences, and I haven't even told you about networking events in evangelical megachurches, which were also a great challenge to me. But you know, behind all this, you know, were there people I was with, meeting in the boot camps and the networking events and the coaching events, were people for whom this was real life, were not, you know, undercover journalists, but in fact had experienced the trauma of job loss very recently in most cases. Well, not so recently. Some had been looking for many months. And what I learned from them was something about the downward trajectory that follows job loss. They're, you know, if at first people obviously try to cut back on their expenses, you know, eliminate the movies, the meals out, and anything like that. They may sell their house, very common. Single people often talk to me about moving back in with their parents. And you keep doing that sort of thing. At some point, your unemployment runs out, 6 months now, it's all we have of it. And if you had a severance package, you would exhaust that. Of course, you may be spending money, as I was, on these supposed aids to your job search. There are various catch-22s along the way. One of them is that more and more employers today insist on a perfect credit rating as a condition for employment. Now, if, you know, that is a hard thing to maintain when you have no income. And when you have no health insurance, it is even harder to maintain. You know, because I should point out, too, that job loss is a major risk factor for depression, which is a major risk factor for any number of physical ailments. So, you know, you get some medical bills. That can damage your credit rating, and that can make you unemployable to many people. Another kind of catch-22 is that the longer you are looking for a job, the longer you are unemployed, the less likely you are to get a job, which sounds strange. But the reason, as is explained over and over in the world of white-collar job seekers, is that you cannot have a gap on your resume. It's even worse than a gap in your zipper. You know, that every second of your life should have been filled up with money-making work. But, of course, if you're not working, how are you going to explain that? That's, you know, it always counts against you. What a lot of people that I talk to do at some point is they, you know, swallow their pride, and they go down to Walmart or, you know, Circuit City or someplace, and get a job at $8 an hour or whatever is being offered, and take that. They get a little cash flow anyway, although that is, if you have a family, that is a poverty-level job. And then people are in the kind of situation where, you know, the people that write to me who read Red Nickel and Dimed and started out somewhat higher in the scheme of things. Now, that job, you know, is not, you no longer show up in the unemployment statistics once you take a job of any kind, because we don't measure underemployment in this country. But it's not a job you can put on your resume and only contributes to the gap. So I want to turn this into a discussion fairly quickly, but to generalize, I mean, as many have said before me, and I think Lou Dobbs says it on CNN every night now, the middle class in this country is in trouble. I've always, in the past, kind of concentrated on the long-term poor. I see that was a rather short-sighted view of poverty in America. You have to include this constant ejection of people from the middle class. But the middle class in this country, the educated middle class, has had, sadly, often had a tendency to look down on the poor as the people who didn't try hard enough or as the people who, made the wrong choices, as I said at the beginning. What comes through very clearly to me from this experience is that wherever you are now, just about, unless you're in a stratosphere that I have never been close to, that situation of poverty, that could be you in 2 years. That could be you in 1 year. That could be you in 6 months. There is no security. And there is very little safety net to halt the fall once you start falling. It is ridiculous that we have health insurance attached to our jobs in this country when our jobs are not attached to us. That has to change. Universal health insurance, anybody? And we need some kind of corporate accountability for the way they treat people. I could suggest so many ways, but I think the most limited and, you know, obvious thing to say is that government at all levels in this country is constantly giving tax breaks and subsidies to businesses in the name of job creation. Well, here's an example. The American Jobs Creation Act of 2005 is huge tax breaks for countries who repatriate money they had overseas. One of the companies getting one of these breaks is Hewlett-Packard, going to get, I think it's $8 billion in a tax break, at a time when they have announced layoffs of 14,500 people. Now, this is not job creation. It's job destruction. And we need political leaders with a backbone to stand up to companies like that and say, you're not getting this anyway. Now, I am on a bit of a crusade here. This is not just for me a book tour. I want to enlist people who have had experiences of job loss and instability or can't stand it. How many people here have lost a job at some point in their lives? Ah. How many people are looking for jobs now? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to throw it open. I'm going to try to get people to leave their email addresses with some people who will be their local contacts. And I've done this in 9 cities now, and I'm excited by the energy there is among white-collar, middle-class people to figure out how to take on these issues that affect both them, or us, I should say, and the poor in America. So I hope tonight leads to that, too. And let me stop right there and open this up for discussion.
Well, I'm pleased to say that Ms. Ehrenreich is going to answer questions, and we do have pads of paper, I might say, for that email address outside in the back on the table, and I believe there will be also upstairs in the lobby. So if you want to be part of that network, please put your email address there. As many of you know, I'm Elliot Shelcrott, the president of the library, and we have volunteers on each side with microphones. It's very important that you use the microphone. The volunteers will get to you as quickly as possible. There are people upstairs in the lobby of the library, as well as those down here, and we want everybody to be able to hear. So please raise your hand if you have a question. The first person I saw was in the white shirt there on my left.
You started to say something about age discrimination. Did you find age to be a factor?
Yes, I mentioned that. That, you know, I was advised to have no experience that went back more than 10 years in my resume. I get the impression that for many people, the white-collar corporate career goes along with from job loss to, you know, rehiring, lower pay each time is the rule, until at some point you just get too old to be rehired. And that could be late 40s. So... And so that for, you know, some people, the kind of life cycle is go through this white collar life, and then when you hit 55 or 60, that's when you become a blue collar worker. Not a retire. I mean, pensions are, that word is P-E-N-S-I-O-N. It's an archaic concept that many of you may be too young to have heard of, but only 20% of Americans have company sponsored pensions anymore.
Okay, gentlemen, right here, and then we'll come to the center one and then two.
I was wondering how you feel how the decline in union membership has affected the change in the mentality of the corporate environment.
Well, the decline in union membership, I think, largely represents the hostility of employers to unionization. In the blue collar world, in the white or blue collar world, you can be fired for anything. We work at will, most of us. And if you can be fired for anything, you can be fired for being a troublemaker. Although it is strictly speaking, illegal to fire people for union activism, it happens all the time. I think also some of our union leadership could be more energetic about organizing low paid people. And I would like to see, although I don't know if the unions are the groups to do this, but it would be interesting if they would try reaching out to the insecure white-collar people, too.
Okay. Gentleman right here.
As an adjunct to what's just been asked about unionization, how can you explain the zealotry of a lot of the Christian conservatives, many of whom are not people of any great means, for right-wing policies that really don't help them, and indeed the fact that this entire country at the moment is in an extremely conservative political mode. And yet many people are barely hanging on. You don't have a savings rate. The saving rate is zero. And people are dissaving, looking to the value of their homes to live out of. And one lady in a group I was with today said, well, the boomers, they go into debt. They don't really seem to care. And essentially, we're looking at some sort of shipwreck nationally, aren't we, in a few years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe sooner than a few years. I think, like many of us, I was utterly shocked by the fumbling of the government on all levels in the face of the recent hurricanes. And I think I've drawn an analogy between that inability to come to the rescue in a case of a collective disaster and the inability to come to the rescue in a case of an individual disaster, like job loss or illness. We just can't seem to get it together. As for people voting against their own interests, there's one thing I learned in bait and switch by going to these evangelical job search meetings, because I don't normally hang out in evangelical megachurches. So I had to be gotten into them for these what were purportedly networking events but actually proselytizing events. And what I realized is that some of these evangelical churches have become social service centers for people. Now, this is in addition to what Tom Frank wrote in his great book, What's the Matter with Kansas? I'm making another observation, that if you need after-school care for your children or help with your job search, you're going to find very little from public sources, but you can find it at your church if your church is big enough. And that church simultaneously, I mean, I think great, churches should be doing things like that. That's wonderful. But if the church is simultaneously preaching, as they do, that you should vote against the person who is pro-choice and vote against the person who is pro-gay marriage, Then it is really preaching that you have to vote against any expansion of public services, like after-school care or anything else. See, abortion and gay rights become like code words. If you just vote on those grounds, you are voting against your own economic self-interest. But the church is also what is providing more and more services to you, if that makes sense. You're looking skeptical, but that's what I discovered there.
Okay. The next person right behind there.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about where your title comes from, the bait and switch, and how that relates to what you're writing about in this book. And I also wonder about your experience in, as you were trying to get jobs, how the process of getting interviewed as opposed to the process of getting offers. Mm-hmm. Were you more successful at one than the other? Yeah. Were they equal?
The title... I have to admit, authors don't make up their titles. Publishers make them up. But what it refers to is that so many young people are lured into the corporate world as a place where they will find some stability and security and affluence. The biggest undergraduate major in America today is business. The most popular graduate degree is the MBA. And I've talked to some kids, because I do a lot of speaking on college campuses, where it's really sad. I remember this student who told me he loved psychology, but he was going to go into marketing, which would draw on his psychology, because it just wasn't safe to go into psychology. Well, it's not safe to go into marketing, is what I want to tell that kid. I want to go back there and shake him and say, stick to your true love, because there's no safety where you think you're going. Now, the other part of that question was the... interviews. I found it very hard to get interviews, to get a foot in the door, to get a nibble, to get anything at all. I hate to give away the plot of this book, but I finally got an offer. I finally aced a couple of interviews with Aflac, the supplemental health insurance company, with the annoying commercial. And... is incredible. The guy interviewing me had a duck. A tie covered with little yellow ducks. And there was a rubber duck on the desk. And anyway, after 2 1-hour long interviews, he said, "Well, you've got the job if you want it." So I said, "What's the pay?" "No pay." "How about the health insurance?" I said, like a fool. And he said, "No. You'd just be selling it. You wouldn't be getting it. Where would you be working from? Your home, home office." Now, this did not fit my definition of a job somehow. And yet 13 million Americans work in these commission-only sales situations where more than half earn less than $10,000 a year. And you know what the real deterrent to me was for this, quote, job? Was not that there were no pay, no benefits, but that I would have had to put up $2,000 up front to get my broker's license to get into the business. And that's typical. Mary Kay, you have to put up about $1,900 to have some inventory to sell. So you're taking a big risk, and they're not taking any risks on you. Sink or swim, it doesn't matter to them.
Okay, another question. We're going to go all the way in the back in the middle, then we're going to come up here to the gentleman on my right. But right in the middle, and we'll get you two shortly, sir.
Hi, Barbara. I'm a big fan of yours. And just wondering if you're ever going to return to writing more politically critical books like The Worst Years of Our Lives and The Snarling Citizen, as versus these reality-based books, Nickel and Diming and, Bait and Switch.
Well, the other books you referred to were collections of essays and columns. They were not freestanding, narratives or something. So there may be another collection in the offing, if that's what you're looking for. But I don't take great pleasure in writing about electoral politics, except in a rather ironic fashion. It's hard for me to take a lot of it seriously. By the way, there was a story I put in Bait and Switch, which I think is pretty political. It's a critique of the corporate culture. A woman who had risen quite high in her corporation was subjected to a personality test on a company retreat. And the result, one of the questions was to check what was her favorite form of humor. She checked irony. Her boss called her in the next day and said that if she wanted to continue to work at that place, she would have to alter her tastes in humor. And when I read that, I thought, oh, my God, you know, no wonder.
Did you know what it meant? I don't know.
I think there is a real problem in this country of irony deficiency disease.
Okay, yes, up front here. Go ahead. There you go.
I'm wondering if now that you've written books from both the white-collar and blue-collar worlds, with the situation becoming more desperate for people in white-collar jobs, do you think that there's – what do you think will happen in the future? Do you think that white-collar workers will see more alliance now with the working poor? And if that happens, do you see some kind of possible change in the society happening?
Yeah. That's what I'm hoping to see. To overcome the distance that has often been there, and some of the class prejudice on the part of white collar people toward those who do manual labor, I would like to see that happen. There are so many things, though, you know, as I discovered in working on Bait and Switch, that operate to keep white collar people in line ideologically. All this stuff about being positive and perky and upbeat, you know, says you cannot be angry. You cannot be resentful about your last firing or anything. You've got to get rid of those emotions. Anybody here read Who Moved My Cheese? Companies buy that book and make their white-collar people read it. And it has a very simple message, which is you're going to be jerked around all your life. Get used to it. Right? That's all it says. So I feel like that's what I'm trying to overcome. Say, no, don't take it, and ally with your natural allies, which would be other workers.
The gentleman in the back there who has had his hand up for a while is the other side, but the excuse me. No, you won't be able to reach him. Let's just, if you'll wait just a second.
I think we should just call on people in the aisles. You know.
Thank you.
Hi. I was wondering if you're aware of the fact that our white-collar legislature in Harrisburg here has given themselves 16 to 54% raises while they won't touch the blue-collar minimum wage of $5.15. And if you could comment on that or that situation generally throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know about them voting themselves a raise, but I do think it is embarrassing that Pennsylvania has not been one of the states that has gone ahead and raised its own minimum wage without waiting for the federal government to do so. You know, this is a state that has, you know, some history of social conscience, and here you are at $5.15 an hour. You know, I know there is a movement here for a living wage and for raising the minimum wage. How do we get in touch with that movement? Who represents it or knows? Okay, can you just say how you get in touch? Neighborhood networks.
Yes, which is a new citywide progressive organization.
And that would be neighborhoodnetworks.org?
Neighborhoodnetworks@googlegroups.net.
That's a little complicated. All right.
Okay.
Okay,
there was a woman in the middle right there. If you want to get the microphone to her, that would be great.
Thank you, anyway, for...
Yeah.
Hi, it strikes me in a lot of what you're saying that it's part of a kind of overall cultural illness that we've been suffering from for some time and continues. I used to work in the corporate world and left it by choice and disgust. I think that there's a combination of no accountability, which we see, I think, in our politicians at the highest levels, and no tolerance for error. It seems to me that we all make mistakes in life at whatever we do. Students make mistakes. They may be allowed in a progressive school to try again at the paper. In a corporation, it's so much easier to fire someone than to take the time and energy to teach that person how to do what you want them to do. There is no culture of training. There's a do it my way or get out, or if we fail, let me fire you so I don't have to take the fall for it. And we see that in our corporations, and we see it in our schools, and we see it all over. And I wonder if you could comment on that a bit in terms of how that, you know, when you see it in our government so grossly, how that contributes to what you found in your job search.
Well, that's interesting. I had not thought about that. You know, I met a lot of people who had not been fired for errors, but it seemed to me had been fired because they did too well. People who often claimed that they had gotten a promotion shortly before the axe fell, they had been praised, they had gotten an award. And, you know, the explanation, which, you know, I couldn't have figured out for myself, was that their salary had risen to the point where they were a more tempting cost cut for some bean cutter in the corporation. And as a friend of mine who is a software designer for GE has said to me, getting a little raise compared to your colleagues is like having a bullseye painted on your back. So that's another part of being a culture of incompetence. Does it prevent error? Well, look at Vioxx. Look at, there's a company that was just in the news recently that makes bulletproof vests, in addition to those worn by President Bush and Laura Bush, but they don't work. We just found out. Somebody there, right? I don't know. They were, you know, it seems to me there's way too much error, even if there is a kind of vindictiveness that you're talking about and desire to. Yeah.
Then you're not going to be able to correct.
Good point. Okay. Yeah, I see your point.
Ma'am, excuse me. I will not call on you unless you sit down. You had something very interesting to say. I know you are upstairs, but you have to sit down. I'm sorry, everybody. Just trying to be helpful. Yes, the woman in the back had something that she wanted to add. She was upstairs, and she asked me if she could please add some information.
Thank you for letting me share this. I'm a member of the Minimum Wage Coalition. Our website is inourinterest.org, and we'd love people to build a coalition around this issue. It's a very hot issue right now. They'll be voting on it in the Pennsylvania House on October 18th, and there's even going to be a rally in Harrisburg sponsored by the coalition.
Okay. Where will the rally be?
It's in Harrisburg. There's buses going from JFK Plaza to Harrisburg on October 18th.
Okay.
You can look at inourinterest.org.
Okay.
All right. We have time for just a few more questions. The gentleman right there on the aisle, why don't you, yes, give it the microphone to him.
Given the history of advances that have happened in society, from affirmative action to voting rights to Social Security, that were at one time written off as unpopular, not feasible, something that would never, ever happen, or something that someone didn't want to happen, do you think at some point that national health care, however unpopular it might be in Washington, is an inevitability?
You know, I would have said definitely yes 25 years ago. It seems so inevitable. I mean, our health care mess is dragging down the economy in many ways. Why is GM in so much trouble? In part because of health care costs for its employees. You know, the other side of the individual burden is the burden on companies, because they're being asked to put, you know, to provide insurance in ever-growing amounts of premiums. And their response in many cases is just to cut the coverage that they give to employees. I wrote a column not too long ago suggesting that the health system had become unhealthy for America. But it sabotages individual lives. It sabotages whole businesses. Other countries have figured this out. You know, maybe they're not perfect. Maybe they, you know, have some problems. But we are letting this destroy us. And it seems to me we're only going to get change, though, if we take it as seriously as we take some other issues. I mean, a lot of us will vote up or down a candidate depending on the war or reproductive rights or something like that. I'm saying health care has to be one of those issues. Then do something or not.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a little bit after 9. I promised Ms. Ehrenreich that we would finish the questions at 9 because she wants a chance to meet you, and many of you want to meet her upstairs.
I have to get my volunteers.
And okay.
Yes. Do I have a couple of people at least who would like to pull together people in this city, in Philadelphia, who would like to talk about employment-based issues, including exchange of stories, reading books, deciding on an activist agenda, and keep in touch with me and with others, people doing this around the country? Also, I forgot to remind you, I have a website, BarbaraEhrenreich.com, where you're invited to post stories, ideas, et cetera. But do I have a couple of, what do they say in the evangelical churches? Do I have a witness? do I have to appoint somebody? Okay.
Gentleman over here on our right.
Okay. And there's great. A woman over there. Yep. I'm going to ask another one. So are there four people who have put up their hands? Will you please stand up for a minute just so everybody can see you? And I'm going to ask you, these are the organizers. I'm going to ask you to be Philadelphia organizers of, well, it doesn't have any name but since white-collar folks often don't have enough of unions, we need other ways of meeting and getting together. I'm going to ask you to sit with me as I sign books and take names and email address, not or just email addresses, of people who would like to get together and continue the discussion. Okay?
Great. And you can, upstairs in the lobby would be the best place to try to find these people. Thank you, Barbara Ehrenreich.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.